Thank you very much. It's good to see so many people here. I'm sorry that my job this morning is to give you all the bad news. But at least we can start off first with the bad news, and then things will get better as the morning progresses. And unfortunately, when we look at this area, the science of climate change, and try to understand what it means from a Baha'i perspective, we really look and say, how do science and religion relate to each other? What is the message that science is giving us today in this area? So I'm trying to share a little. I've been working as an advisor to governments on environmental issues for 39 years. So a long time I was sort of crying in the wilderness about issues of climate change. Today people are finally waking up to things we've been concerned about many years ago. Why are we worried about an issue like this? This is a short quote from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, which is a global think tank on strategic issues, a year ago, when they said, if climate change goes unchecked, its effects will be catastrophic on the level of nuclear war. Now, this is not scientists, this is political specialists saying this is what this issue means for the world today. The security dimension will come increasingly to the forefront as countries begin to see falls in available resources and economic vitality, increased stress on their armed forces, greater instability in regions of strategic import, increases in ethnic rivalries, and a widening gap between rich and poor. So all of you here interested in issues of socioeconomic development, climate change is threatening to knock us all back the other way, which is why it's so important to talk about it in this context. Very briefly, I'll take you a 100-yard dash through the science of climate change. We know that the planet is a habitable place because in the atmosphere there are certain gases that are a kind of a filter. What's called the greenhouse effect is because in a greenhouse the sun comes through the glass windows and it warms up the inside and the heat doesn't go out again so quickly, so it stays warm inside. And that's why our planet is a habitable place. Among those gases is carbon dioxide, a very common gas, and in fact originally on this planet the atmosphere was mostly carbon dioxide and nitrogen. There was no oxygen in the original atmosphere of the planet. It was the early life of the planet that removed the carbon dioxide and generated oxygen so animals could live on the planet. And they stored that carbon in the layers of the Earth, making what we now see as coal and oil, the fossil fuels that are buried in the Earth. Unfortunately, what hundreds of millions of years of biological activity have done to make the planet habitable, we are undoing in a couple of hundred years, which is why we are seeing this rapid process of climate change. As the greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere and trap more heat, we see changes in the circulation of air and currents in the oceans. We can't predict with any scientific accuracy what this is going to mean in any particular place. The weather has always been unpredictable. Chaos is an important part of the system, so we can't say it's going to be colder in Chicago or warmer in Miami or something of this sort. But we can say, in general, what's happening to the planet, and that's what we try to do with the scientific information. And this report that Peter referred to, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was set up by the United Nations for scientists from all the countries of the world to define the global scientific consensus, has said there is a clear sign of human-caused climate change. If we look at the graphs, if you can see this graph, I can't probably use a pointer, but you see along the line from 1,000 years ago, back to the year 1000, how level the line of climate change, carbon dioxide levels are, and then at the end, we're at 325 parts per million today. You can just see it's shooting off the graph. This is what we're doing to change the behavior of the planetary system. But it's not only carbon dioxide. That first graph is the top of the three there. We also have methane, a very important greenhouse gas produced by cows. So if you have a steak, that produced methane, produced by the decomposition of peaty materials in the Florida Everglades or in the Arctic permafrost and other areas, by rice paddies in Southeast Asia, by leakages from your natural gas supplies, and so on. All of this helps to encourage global warming. You can see its curve is the same thing. It's relatively level, and now it's shooting through the ceiling. Nitrous oxides are produced by things like burning fossil fuels, driving your car. And again, they're also going to, and they're even more powerful than the others. So we're adding several gases to the atmosphere that are all together producing a very rapid process of warming of the planet. And we know that carbon dioxide and temperature are linked. These are the scientific analyses. You see carbon dioxide in the top graph, the levels of carbon dioxide. Because the saw-like shape was the ice ages. When it got warmer and colder in the ice ages, carbon dioxide went up and down. The lower graph is temperature. And as you see, temperature and carbon dioxide are very closely linked. They follow exactly the same curves. So scientifically, it's clear carbon dioxide is linked to the warming process. The graphs on the right side show what is happening with carbon dioxide going through the ceiling and what is happening with temperature. Both are going in the same direction. Now, we are all responsible for climate change. Every single person here is guilty of causing this problem. If you've ever burned fossil fuels, if you drove here or you flew here, except maybe a few of you walked here or bicycled here, but apart from that, we all contributed to climate change just by coming to this conference. Everybody who's benefited from land clearing, from changes in land use, has contributed to climate change, because whenever you cut a forest, all the carbon in that forest eventually ends up as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. How much we're responsible depends on where we live, what country we're in, our lifestyle, our consumption patterns, with the rich being obviously the most responsible. They've done the most to cause the damage. And yet, as Peter said, the poor are the greatest victims. And we saw that last night in Carol's presentation. They've done little or nothing to cause the problem, and they're the ones who are going to pay the heaviest price. So this is fundamentally an ethical dilemma, why it's important for Baha'is to consider this issue very fundamentally. If we look, for instance, this map shows in the size of the circles the emissions of carbon dioxide from industrial processes, from all that we've been done in our developed countries. And you can see North and Central America, Europe, and Asia are the big contributors in terms of what has come from our industrial civilization. If we look at land use changes, suddenly we see what South America, Africa, Asia are more responsible, because there's much more land use change taking place now in those areas. And so about 60% of the problem has come from industrial activities, 40% from land use change, all together contributing. So we are all guilty of helping to cause this problem. It's interesting the different ways in which you can sort of allocate or assign that responsibility. This graph shows carbon dioxide emissions per capita. You know, what does each individual human being on this planet done to cause the problem? You may not be able to see the fine print. The very highest line there is the United States. The next one is Saudi Arabia, Australia, Canada, Czech Republic, Norway, and so on. And way, way down near the bottom is China. So China, in per capita levels, is one of the countries contributing the least to the problem. And so if you're, say, negotiating internationally who is responsible, if you do it person by person, clearly America, the United States, is the one that has been the biggest contributor to the problem. Canada is up there, and so on. If you look at the country share, country by country, global emissions, the highest bar is the total. The next bar is what they call the OECD countries, the developed countries of the world together. Then the next bar down is for the G8 countries, the U.S. and Canada and so on, the most industrious countries. Then the European Union is a smaller one. That tiny little line at the very bottom is all the least developed countries. So they've done almost nothing, even if they are going to pay most of the price. If you take a map in which the size of the country relates to their energy emissions, you can see America, U.S. is greatly inflated. Canada is much smaller up there in the corner. Europe is sort of middle-sized. China is quite significant. Japan has become an enormous set of islands. But look at the tiny little bits of Africa. You know, they've done almost nothing. And yet, they're the continent that will suffer the most. If we look at the historical emissions, how much have we contributed to the problem since the early 1800s, the beginning of the industrial era? We see that great big bar on the left is the United States, then the Russian Federation, China, Germany, United Kingdom, Japan, France, India, Canada, Poland, and so on. Again, a few rich countries have by far made the largest historical contribution, which is why the governments say, well, they're the ones who should first make the effort to change their behavior. They caused the problem, they should be responsible for paying for the pollution that they caused. You can also look by sector, and there in the round graph, the great big major part of that is our energy production. Some of that, the gray part is land use change and agriculture, but you can see most of what this is coming is because we're using energy. And of course, energy is fundamental to development. Energy is what allows us to have more than just muscle power or horse power or, you know, ox power to do something. So energy is critical to any kind of development. And yet that energy is what's causing the problem. The scientific evidence is that climate change is going to be stronger and sooner than even the most pessimistic ecologists expected a few years ago. Things have really been accelerating. Just since 2000, carbon dioxide emissions have accelerated much more than was before. For instance, in the 1990s, the rise was 0.7% per year. Since the year 2000, it's about 2.9% per year. So instead of slowing the problem, it's getting worse very fast. The three main causes: growth in the world economy. Maybe that will slow down a little bit. Suddenly the world economy is shaking. That might be a good thing from the point of view of climate change. The rise of coal use in China, where they're planning to build over 500 new coal-fired power plants. The weakening of natural carbon sinks, because nature helps us with this. Carbon dioxide is taken up by plant life, by forests, and so on. And so some of the carbon dioxide we've released has been absorbed by natural systems and put back into the carbon cycle. But that's slowing down. We're saturating the system. It's no longer helping us the way it did before. This is the global temperature trends. If you say, is there global warming? Again, you can see a long, relatively stable period, and suddenly things are shooting up, and those different parts in gray are the predictions to the end, to up to 2100. You know, the next 90 years, that's what the temperature is expected to do. This is just show what's already happened. Temperature increases in the last 50 years. The red spots are the places that have gotten the hottest. So this is why we say climate change has already started. There are very big temperature changes already taking place. And you know, it's particularly in the polar areas. And while climate change science is not perfect, scientists are always debating interpretations of the data, and particularly in North America, there have been powerful interests trying to discredit the science of climate change. As they try to discredit the science about smoking and cancer, there's been a very, very strong campaign, millions and millions of dollars spent to try to convince Americans that, oh, there's doubt, it's only a theory, don't worry about it, we can wait. And yet, as you can see, every single argument presented has been disproved one after the other, and this latest report from the IPCC, even though you'll see it's extreme, has been very conservative about what is said. It's excluded all the projections that might be too frightening. It's just what we know with absolute certainty, not the things that are likely or probable. And the signs of climate change, the world is already responding. My work in biology has demonstrated that you can see the changing distributions of plants and animals going up mountains to higher and higher elevations as things get warmer on the California coast. Mexican species are now found at San Francisco, and things in South Africa are now up there in Seattle or further north. There's enormous shifts taking place. You know, the biological systems are already responding to climate change. The number of the highest, most powerful cyclones or hurricanes has increased in all the oceans in the last 30 years. The last 12 years have seen 11 of the warmest ever recorded on the planet, at least in recent geological times. This is what the models say, used by the IPCC. You can see the temperature curves for various different scenarios. The red one at the bottom is if we stay at year 2000 levels of carbon dioxide, don't do anything, stop driving, stop everything, you know, 8 years ago. The others are what temperature will be doing, and you can see in the maps on the right, the temperature increase as the world is getting redder and redder and redder as it warms up. This, of course, you know, the heat you might say be collecting first in the tropics, but because of this ocean current system, what they call the global conveyor belt of the ocean currents take that heat from the tropics up to the polar areas. And this is why we see some of the greatest impacts at the poles. And there we can already half the permafrost expected to melt by 2050, 90% by 2100, 14% of all the permanent ice in the Arctic Ocean melted in the year 2005, and another 23% in the year 2007, the worst melting ever. Last year, this last summer, it was not quite as much, but almost. And they're now saying the Arctic Ocean may be ice-free by 2015 to 2030. I used to say by 2100, then it was 2050, then 2040. Every year I have to rewrite my notes because the data is getting worse. The Greenland glaciers have doubled the rate of flow into the sea. Because this is ice on the land. When it goes into the sea, it raises sea levels. So sea levels are already rising. And the West Antarctic ice sheet is also showing instabilities and could easily be adding much more to the rate of sea level rise. Did Abdu'l-Bahá know about global warming? If you go to the Tablets of the Divine Plan, he says, should the fire of the love of God be kindled in Greenland, all of the ice of that country will be melted and its cold weather become temperate. 1916. This is well before Al Gore. I also heard when I was a kid, Abdu'l-Bahá said palm trees would grow in Chicago and in Montreal. They said, he said that about Montreal too. So clearly Abdu'l-Bahá knew something that we didn't know in those days. This is what we expect to happen with the temperatures in the Arctic by 2090. This is what's predicted decrease in the Arctic ice ocean cover. The bottom series of circles, you can see 2010, 2040, 2070. The top circles is what we had in 1982, but look at 2007. It's already half the size what was predicted in 2004 to be 2010. That shows how fast this process has been accelerating. The black areas are the permanent ice this is more than 6 years old in the Arctic Ocean. And you can see in 1988, 1990, 2001, 2005, there's not much permanent ice left. What's left there now is relatively recent, thinner ice that will go faster. This is not just in the polar areas. This is a glacier in Argentina, 1928, 2004. One of our glaciers in the Alps, where I live in Switzerland, in 1859 and 2001. Not much left of that one. If those of you who like to go skiing, the red areas are the areas where we'll see a more than 75% in reduction in snow cover by 2080. Better change your winter sports. And global temperatures are rising very rapidly. Ocean temperatures are rising even in the deep oceans. Glaciers are decreasing all around the world. Sea level has risen more than doubled and is now accelerating. We're probably approaching a tipping point where runaway climate change will be catastrophic, which is why, because there are positive feedbacks that come into play, which is why they say we have maybe 10 years left to turn all of world civilization around and change our release of greenhouse gases. We look at the impacts of climate change. As you see, the different projected increases in temperature, we have falling crop yields, even in the most developed countries, collapse in water supplies, sea level rising, extensive damage to coral reefs, we'll talk about in a minute, rising numbers of species driven extinct. They may say 25 to 50% of all the species may be lost as a result of climate change. So this is an enormous impact on natural systems. This is what happens to agricultural productivity. The red areas could see a 50% reduction in agricultural productivity by 2080. This is what happens to rainfall. All the red and orange areas are areas that will experience seriously decreased precipitation in winter or in summer or both. Much of the inhabited parts of the world, all across India, Europe, parts of China, and so on, we'll see enormous decreases in water available to grow food. Loss of biodiversity. The lower maps show, with the various scenarios, how much of the world's biodiversity will be lost by 2050. Just as an example, the beech forests of the southeastern United States are expected to be growing up there where we used to see the maple trees in Canada. So we have enormous shifts in populations as the conditions change and things that used to grow one place will no longer be able to grow there and have to find another place to grow, assuming they can get up and run all that distance, which is not so easy for a forest. Same thing in South Africa. or where you have major reductions, say in grass down biomes, other areas, temperature changes, and the areas for those different communities shrink. Coral reefs, which is my own special scientific field, protect tropical coasts, provide fish, but global warming is threatening them with probably complete destruction. This is what is predicted to happen. The red areas are areas where the temperature will be too warm for coral reefs to grow by 2050, 2059, so in the next 40 years. And of course, reefs will only grow more slowly or be bleached by the temperature. Carbon dioxide, when it dissolves in seawater, makes it more acid. And this prevents the corals from making their skeletons. This is what's predicted to happen to ocean acidification by 2100. As the oceans become suddenly much more acid, all the things with shells, mollusks and corals and other kinds of sea life, will no longer be able to make their skeletons. And you can imagine what that will do to the ecology of those systems. So scientists predict that in this century, we're apt to see the catastrophic collapse of the Arctic Ocean and Greenland ice sheets, the Amazon rainforest, which is expected to dry out and burn and become a savanna, the northern boreal forests, El Nino affecting the weather across North America, Southeast Asia, and Africa, the collapse of the West African monsoon, the Indian summer monsoon becoming very much too wet and flooding in some years and drought in others. These are major changes at the planetary level. And this, of course, will mean human impacts of all different kinds in terms of agriculture, forestry, fishing, diseases, sea level rise, millions of environmental refugees. The red areas are expect to see malaria coming back by 2050. See, a good part of Florida is in that area. Goodbye, Orlando. Start taking your pills now. Food insecurity. The graph on the lower right is what happens in developing countries in terms of the food they can produce for themselves. This is sea level rise as already experienced during the industrial age. So you can see it's clearly going up and up and up. And these are the projections to 2100. The gray part of the graph is what the IPCC has predicted for sea level rise. But in the smaller graph, you can look at the red line, which is the observed sea level rise. It's already far above the predictions of the IPCC. They were very conservative in what they were predicting. What does this mean? Well, if we see this sea level rise by 1 meter sea level rise, this means losing, flooding of over 2 million square kilometers, displacing 145 million people, causing damage of nearly $1,000 billion, just for 1 meter of sea level rise. This is what happens, for instance, in Bangladesh, where they lose 15% of their land area and displace 1.5 million people just in the one country. If you lived on a coral island, what would you do if the sea level rose? I used to live there, so I know. That was my laboratory when I was working at the Smithsonian and the coral reefs of Belize. This is an atoll of Butaritari and Kiribati. When I was advisor to the governments of the Pacific Islands, I was warning them 30 years ago about the dangers of climate change. You can see there's no place to get up to get away from sea level rise. It's a very, very flat country. A bit of coral, rubble and sand, some coconut trees, palm trees growing on it, and that's climbing up the palm trees doesn't get you very far when the sea level comes up. This is what's happening in Tuvalu, the next door country. What would you feel to have the waves washing across the road in front of your house? And there are already predictions that even by 2010, we'll begin to see increasing numbers of climate refugees from flooded delta areas like the Nile or the Mekong or the Ganges or the yellow areas where drought will be displacing people because there's simply no more water to drink or to grow food, or all the purple areas where there'll be increased storm damage, as you saw in New Orleans and other areas. Major parts of the world already by 2010 are going to be impacted. And of course, this is expensive as well. This is the decade-by-decade increase in the costs of natural disasters. And of course, this has gone up since these graphs were done. So we, 1998 saw a record $112 billion. In 2005, when New Orleans got hit by Katrina and Rita, we saw over $200 billion. The insurance companies are pulling their hair out. What do they do about this? They just can't cope. The Stern Report, this British economist, was commissioned by the government in the United Kingdom to calculate the cost of climate change. He said the annual cost, if we don't do anything, is $660 billion a year. Now, this used to seem big until suddenly the banks collapsed and we found thousands of billions of dollars to save the banks. But what's left to save the rest of us? Climate change, as Stern pointed out, was the greatest market failure in human history. And of course, it's happening because we are addicted. Like a heroin addict just has to get his heroin fix. We have to get our fossil fuel fix. We can't live without it. 80% of our economy depends on fossil fuels. Transportation, communications, trade, agriculture, urbanization, our consumer lifestyle all depend on abundant, cheap energy. Our needs are expected to increase 50% by 2030, and adapting to that change is going to be horrendously expensive, particularly places like the United States that have been ignoring this problem for so long. A journalist last year commented, on current trends, humanity will need twice as much energy as it uses today within 35 years. Produce too little energy, said the economists, and there will be price hikes and a financial crash unlike any the world has ever known, with possible resource wars, depression, and famine. I don't know, maybe this is of course written before we saw the crash begin, so it's on its way. Produce the wrong sort of energy, said the climate scientists, and we will have more droughts, floods, rising seas, and worldwide economic disaster with runaway global warming. Of course, the real danger is, the most likely probably, is we will do both at the same time. And of course, our institutions haven't been responding to the problem. No politician will sacrifice immediate economic growth for this problem. Even he says it's good to be sustainable, but let somebody else do that after the next election. We have deep social divisions that make it very hard for us to come together and agree on these things, whether it be nationally or internationally. Climate change is only one symptom of the fundamental imbalances in the world, and our economic system is taking us in the wrong direction. And of course, we know from the Baha'i community statements that economic thinking is challenged by the environmental crisis, such as, for instance, climate change. And this belief that there is no limit to nature's capacity to fulfill any demand made on it is false. And our culture, based on growth, expansion, acquisition, satisfying our wants, is no longer a realistic guide to policy. Anybody who enjoys living in America should really read closely the quote about the consumer culture in One Common Faith. This gospel of human betterment producing today's consumer culture, pursuing ephemeral goals, and for the small minority of people, which is us, who can afford them, the benefits it offers are immediate and the rationale unapologetic. It's good, it's fun to live this way, but can we let the world go on and have the consequences? What are the ways forward? Clearly, we have to harness, as Shoghi Effendi said, all the available sources of energy on the surface of the planet. The UN has estimated this will cost about $20 trillion over two decades in order to do that. It's not impossible, but it's going to mean a major effort. We've got to reduce our environmental impacts to sustainable limits. We have to accelerate the transition if we want to reduce the shock. If we wait, it's going to hit us over the head like a great big weight. We're going to have to create global governance mechanisms to manage the global change, and Haldor will be talking about that next. And we have to share the costs, the effort, and the benefits globally with equity and justice, which is where the Baha'i community has an important role to play. And we have to recognize that we only can solve this problem globally. There's no other way. You can't legislate nationally to solve this problem. Nor can we separate climate change from all the other global challenges of economic globalization, energy and resource depletion, poverty reduction, social imbalances, security, because these all interact with each other in very complex ways. There's no partial solution. There's only one that Baha'u'llah gave us, called the World Order of Baha'u'llah. This comes from the UNDP Human Development Report that Peter was quoting earlier. Mitigation of climate change asks profound moral and ethical questions of our generation. In the face of clear evidence that inaction will hurt millions of people and consign them to lives of poverty and vulnerability, can we justify inaction? No civilized community adhering to even the most rudimentary ethical standards would answer that question in the affirmative, especially one that lacked neither the technology nor the financial resources to act decisively. We, of course, know from the Baha'i statements that sustainability is an ethical concept. We must be trustees or stewards of the planet's resources and biodiversity. We must ensure sustainability and equity of resource use into the distant future. We must consider the environmental consequences of development activities. We must temper our actions with moderation and humility, and understand the natural world and its role in humanity's collective development, both material and spiritual. And this is what science is telling us today. We have to look at the science. What is science saying? What does this mean in terms of the development we're going to be working for in the years ahead? And fundamentally, we have to say that sustainable environmental management must come to be seen as a fundamental responsibility that must be shouldered, a prerequisite for spiritual development as well as the individual's physical survival. So it's both our physical survival and our spiritual growth that are at stake on this issue. Baha'u'llah warned us that a civilization so often vaunted by the learned exponents of arts and sciences will, if allowed to overleap the bounds of moderation, bring great evil upon men. And we're now seeing that today. We also know that it is unjust to sacrifice the well-being of most people, and even of the planet itself, the advantages which technological breakthroughs can make available to privileged minorities. You know, SUVs or technological breakthrough, cell phones and so on, lots of gadgets of our society, often very energy intensive. We are the privileged minority. So climate change may be the common threat that forces the nations and peoples of the world to work together in their collective interest. And an ethical approach will be essential to convince all of us to act. Thank you very much.